the brethren and sisters and the young people. In the opening comments that Brother Carter has in his book on the Epistle to the Romans, he makes the comment that it has been stated that the Epistle to the Romans is the most profound book in the world. That wouldn't generally be regarded as a very good psychological approach to commencing a book. You don't usually tell people that what they are going to read is going to be difficult. But I think all of us have come to appreciate, even at this stage, what he means by that statement. It's not necessarily at all that the concepts in the book are difficult, but it is a profound book. It does get into the depths of the divine mind. And it shows to us also some of what we might call the intricacies of the human mind. Perhaps one of the things that makes this book so profound for us, and we're going to see this in the introductory verses from chapter 3 this evening, is the Jewish mind. In fact, as we read through Romans, and very often the Apostle Paul puts forward certain questions which he then answers, sometimes we say, well, I can't even understand the question, and let alone see what the significance of the answer is. Well, of course, that's because we perhaps don't appreciate the intricacies of what the Jewish mind was back in those days, and in fact still is today. So it's only really in that sense that it's a profound book. But certainly, it is a great book as far as the subject of the righteousness of God is concerned. And we're coming to that section this evening, we won't really get to that section this evening, but it's certainly in chapter 3, where we're going to really look at the highlight, not only of the book of Romans, but of course of the whole purpose of God, the theme of the righteousness of God. Now, in the notes that were handed out this evening, there's two different groups there. There's a set of four pages which are simply entitled The Epistle to the Romans. You might like to add those on to the front of the existing notes that you've got. That will have mean, of course, that you've got two lots of pages, 1, 2, 3, and 4, but this, in fact, if you like, is a preface. What we've done here is we've endeavoured to do a summary of the book as a whole, because it's very important that as we come in each night, and we do tend to look somewhat microscopically at these chapters, that we don't, as the saying goes, fail to see the wood for the trees. We want to always be able to keep in mind the general overall flow of the argument. And if people are going to find Romans difficult, it's only really because they've lost track of the flow of the argument. Let's perhaps just have a look at what we've got here on page 1, and we'll just read that section from where it says analysis, and it'll give us an overview of the things that we've seen so far in the opening two chapters, because they have been spread out over a period of something like 5 months. In the salutation, which goes to make up the first 7 verses of chapter 1, Paul declares his commission to preach the gospel of the fulfilment of God's promises in his Son to all the Gentiles, and so also to the Romans. He then thanks God for their faith and expresses his longing to visit them and preach to them the gospel of the righteousness of God. And we spent a whole night, didn't we, just looking at the opening salutation and Paul's desire to meet with these Roman brethren whom he hadn't met before and to discuss with them the power of the subject of the righteousness of God. He then goes on to point out in the remainder of chapter 1 that the gospel met the crying need of the whole world, for God's wrath against sin was only too evident. And we saw that in verses 18 through to 32 of that first chapter. He had revealed himself in creation, but men had refused to acknowledge him. So he had left them to be the prey of unnatural lusts and to their own perverted judgment of right and wrong. And so that was the picture as we saw it in chapter 1. The way in which the Gentile world, who although they knew that there was a God, refused to acknowledge it, and God gave them up, and they degraded themselves into the situation as described in that chapter. When we came then to chapter 2 in the opening verses, he now looks at that other class of humanity called the Jews. And the Jews considered themselves to be somewhat different. And so our note says, some indeed blind their eyes to their own relation to this wrath by assuming a position as the judges or the teachers of others. But God requires obedience, not censoriousness, trying each man with absolute fairness by the light he has received and setting no store on the possession of the law and circumcision unless the heart is in correspondence with them. And so in that second chapter, what we saw was that the Jew, because he was a Jew, just automatically thought that he must be better than the Gentile. And immediately we saw a possible situation involving ourselves. We are not Jews after the flesh, but we do call ourselves Christadelphians. And it is very easy to automatically think of ourselves as somewhat of a cut above the world at large. We do trust that our behaviour and our way of life is different from the world about us. But just because we have learned the truth does not automatically make us better and therefore fit us to be in a position to cast judgment on others. That's the danger. That's the trap that the Jew fell into. Because he was a Jew, because he was the seed of Abraham, he just thought that he was automatically better. Do we ever feel like that? Just knowing the truth is not good enough. Already Paul has told us in Romans chapter 1, it's the obedience of faith that God is looking for. And so it is in these opening chapters that the apostle really has analysed what the situation is in the world. This analysis which we've got here is the same one as you've got on the Bible insert, so there's no need, of course, to copy it down. But we can see where we've reached. We considered the introduction, as we've said, the first 15 verses. Verses 16 and 17, the righteousness of God revealed for man's salvation. And then from chapter 1, verse 18, right through to chapter 11, which is a very long section, we have what might be called the doctrine of the righteousness of faith demonstrated. Now this has been divided up into various subsections. The first section, which we shall conclude all being well tonight, is the section entitled Man's Failure to Attain to Righteousness. So you might say that in a sense, our studies of Romans up to this time are perhaps somewhat depressing. Chapter 1 considers the failure of the Gentiles. The second chapter considers the failure of the Jews. And through to chapter 3 and verse 20, which is where we are heading tonight, we consider other aspects of the failure of mankind. And so this section, which goes from chapter 1 verse 18, deals with the failure of the Gentiles in chapter 1, the ground of God's judgment in chapter 2 verses 1 to 16, the failure of the Jews in chapter 2 verses 17 to 29, and then it is our intention this evening to consider the two sections, Jewish objections met in chapter 3 verses 1 to 8, and the witness of Scripture to the failure of man. That will take us through then to chapter 3 verse 20. God willing then in our next class, we will commence chapter 3 verse 21, looking at the way in which the righteousness of God has been revealed. And as Brother Carter says in his book, this section here in chapter 3 and the section in chapter 5, verses 12 to 21, must be the two outstanding sections in the Bible dealing with the subject of the atonement and the righteousness of God. So you can see then where we are heading. Tonight's class is intended to conclude this section dealing with man's failure to attain to righteousness. So that brings us then to chapter 3. Perhaps while we're still open on our general summary, let's read then a summary of what the chapter is about. And you might say, well, having read that, I don't understand it. Well, that's fair enough. I think many of these summaries are much more meaningful after you've studied it and you come back and read them again. But let's read it. We left off about halfway through that second to last paragraph. We start with the words, "The Jew, indeed, was privileged above other men in being entrusted with the oracles of God." That's chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. But God's faithfulness did not depend on his, that is, the Jews. And God's anger may righteously rest upon the nation for its repudiation of the trust, even though that very repudiation brings out God's truthfulness into clearer relief. And I'd venture to say there'll be a few people read that sentence and say, what does that mean? Well, that's all right. That's why it takes 3/4 of an hour in a class to explain some of these things. But if at the end of the class you still can't understand that statement, then we'll need to discuss it a bit further. But hopefully it will be more meaningful. Is it then better to be a Gentile than to incur the additional responsibility of the possession of a trust? By no means. But Jews, as well as Gentiles, are, on the evidence of their own scriptures, under the dominion of sin. And law reveals It cannot break the chains of sin. And we'll leave it at there because at that point, because that's as far as we intend to go in our consideration this evening. So we're going to then turn to Romans chapter 3. And appreciating as we do that when the Apostle Paul wrote the letter to the Romans, he didn't put these chapter divisions in. There is therefore a very definite flow on from the end of chapter 2. Because chapter 2 ended on the note in verse 29, "But he is a Jew, which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God." And that was a very direct statement, and one which the natural Jew did not take kindly to at all. Because the Apostle Paul is saying that as far as true Jewishness is concerned, and we notice how he picks up that word, whose praise is not of men, because the word Jew, being the abbreviated form of the word Judah, really means praise. The true Jew, the one who really brings praise to God, is the one who is a Jew inwardly. And it goes the same for Christadelphians as well. There is no virtue in a fact that a person believes the gospel and is baptised unless they do something about it. Unless their life brings praise to God, then there is no virtue in boasting of the fact that we are Christadelphians. And I use the word boast because that word boast has already come out twice in Romans chapter 2. Well, what Paul does now when he comes to the third chapter is he poses a series of questions. And this happens quite frequently throughout the book. He asks questions which, in a sense, you might say are hypothetical ones. In other words, he raises up a hypothetical objector and he puts questions into the mouth of that person and he then answers them. Now, our exercise for the first half of our class, at least this evening, is going to be to examine the questions as they are found in the opening verses here of John chapter 3. If we can just get some idea of what that looks like on the screen, even though you can't read the words, it doesn't really matter a lot. That's the Bible which I should say most of us are looking at the moment, which is an Oxford. And chapter 3, of course, fits onto this spot of the page. What I've done here is I've chosen two colours which seem to be all right in my Bible but don't come out too well here. They don't contrast enough. What I've done is I've coloured in the question and the answer. 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 And when one sees that there is a series then of four questions and four answers, it makes the reading of the chapter so much different. Just recently I've been doing some work again on Romans chapter 6, and I suppose it's a chapter which, if we were to say what chapter in Romans were we most familiar with, we'd say, well, it's probably Romans chapter 6 because it's read regularly at baptisms. And yet when you read it in the connection and the flow of the whole book, it sounds a little bit different from the way in which it sounds perhaps when we just read it as a chapter in itself. Because that chapter also consists of two questions and two answers. And in fact, it flows on into chapter 7. There are actually three questions and three answers. It's all of chapter 6 and part of chapter 7. And this is the sort of thing that, if we can notice this as we're going through, next time we read the chapter, it becomes much more meaningful to us. And so in the handout notes, and it'll be page 20 that you've got there this evening, we start to deal with these questions and answers. And as I've said, it's probably not a bad idea, if you feel so disposed, to perhaps colour them in your Bible. I use a sort of a pinky colour for the question and a yellow for the answer. And I suppose if your eyesight is quite good, you can actually pick the difference up there. All right, well, let's have a look then at these questions. And as we said in our opening remarks, one of the things that makes Romans seem a profound book is that some of the questions themselves seem a little strange. We'd say, well, whoever would ask a question like that? Well, that's what we've got to find out first of all. We've got to find out what sort of mind would ask that sort of question, and then the answer is usually very easy. Paul, therefore, as we've said, poses four questions that might be raised by Jewish objectors. And he constructs a dialogue between himself and this objector, this Jewish objector which he has created, by setting forth a series of four of their propositions, followed by his answers to each of them. Well, question one is found in verse 1. What advantage then hath the Jew, or what profit is there of circumcision? Now, we must realise that this is a flow-on from the end of chapter 2, isn't it? Remember how chapter 2 ended up? Chapter 2 ended up on the note that he is a Jew which is one inwardly. In other words, it doesn't matter whether you're a Gentile or whether you're a Jew. If you really believe and God's word is in your heart, then you are a true Jew. Whether you are the natural seed of Abraham or not, it doesn't matter. So the Jewish objector comes along naturally with the first question. If that's the case, what advantage is there then in being a Jew? And what profit is there in circumcision? Well, that's a reasonable enough question, isn't it? That's the question. Well, of course, you see, what he'd been saying in the previous chapter was that the fact that the Jew broke the law brought him under condemnation because all of them broke the law. In which case, then, if he was breaking the law, where is his advantage? Well, the answer is in verse 2. Much every way, chiefly because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. So he says there were tremendous advantages in being a Jew. First of all, and chiefly, the Jew had had God's word granted unto him. God's revelation had been committed unto him. Whereas if the Gentile wanted to understand God's purpose, he had to seek it through God's people, through Israel. He had to come to the Jewish book. He had to come to the Jewish scriptures. There are some very good references, and they're noted there. Psalm 147, verses 19 and 20. Psalm 147, and verses 19 and 20 read, "He showeth his word unto Jacob, his statutes and his judgments unto Israel. He hath not dealt so with any nation, and as for his judgments, they have not known them. Praise ye Yahweh." And so it was a great privilege that they had received God's word. If you come back to Romans chapter 3 and just jump down momentarily to verse 30, which we'll comment on in more detail later on, it says there, "Seeing it is one God which shall justify the circumcision by faith and the uncircumcision through the faith." You see the difference? The Jew had been born into a set of circumstances where the faith was part and parcel of his way of life. He lived under the law of Moses. It was God's law. It was holy, it was just, and it was good. All he had to do was to have faith in it. But as far as the Gentile was concerned, he had to first learn the faith and then manifest faith in the faith. So the Gentile was two steps removed. And already the apostle is laying the basis for this point that he's going to make here in his answer to the first question. So what advantage is there? Much every way, because unto them were committed the oracles of God. They were already there. All they had to do was accept them. But what did they do? They have said, "We are Jews. We boast in the fact that we are Jews. You Gentiles haven't been born into our race, therefore we are better than you." And God says, "My wrath will be poured out justly on every man who has rejected me, to the Jew first and also to the Gentile." So the Jew had privileges. It meant that when blessings were to be poured out on mankind, the Jew would get them first. But when God's wrath is poured out upon mankind, the Jew, because of his privileges and because he had rejected those privileges, would also firstly experience the wrath of God, as we read in Romans chapter 2. And I hope as we're going through this, brethren and sisters, that we keep jumping down to the 20th century. And perhaps each time we read the word Jew, we say, well, could it be saying Christadelphian? Could we be like the Jew? Because you see, after all, human nature is identical, really, isn't it? You put it in a certain set of circumstances and it will act quite predictably. There's just the odd person who doesn't, but by and large, we act very predictably. We've been, many of us here, have been brought into circumstances like the Jew. We've been born into the environment of the truth. We've never known anything else. We've just automatically accepted it. I put that hypothetically, because let's hope we haven't, but it's quite possible that could be the case. And therefore we can talk with, to quote that word, censoriousness about those who don't know the truth. and yet just knowing the truth is of no virtue unless it is practiced. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verses 5 to 8 had to remind the Jewish people as they were on the borders of the land of the great responsibilities which they had in receiving the privilege of knowing God's word and God's law. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verses 5 to 8. Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as Yahweh my God commanded me, that ye should do so in the land whither ye go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes, and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great, who hath God so nigh unto them, as Yahweh our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great, that hath statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law, which I set before you this day? Now you can understand, couldn't you, how a Jew reading that very quickly would say, well, that makes me great. Yes, but they were only great potentially to the extent that they were prepared to take hold of God's great law and God's great statutes. And people should look at the Christadelphian community and say, what a great community. Not perhaps the word great in the sense that the world might understand it today, but to recognise that they are a different sort of people. Not just because they claim to be, but because it is seen in their lives. And so, what advantage then hath the Christadelphian? Much every way. If one has been born into that family, then they haven't had to search out the truth. It's already there for them. All they've had to do is to manifest faith in that faith which their parents perhaps before them had accepted. And so we can see how there's the possibility that any of us who are in such a situation as that could well echo the sentiments of the Jew found in Romans. And in John chapter 4, and at verse 22, the Lord could say to the woman of Samaria, words which almost sounded quite egotistical, but he says, ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. And of course that's a very well-known quote, one that we would regularly use in our lectures. Well, I think the point is established, isn't it? But it was that quote from Deuteronomy, brethren and sisters, which I think is the important one, and which picks up the theme, which is now going to flow through some of the rest of these questions. Remember the purpose in God giving this law to Israel, as he expressed there in Deuteronomy chapter 4. It was because of the way in which they were to manifest it to others, to other nations. Keep therefore and do them, it says, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. So when people look at us, they judge God by what they see in us. Again, it reminds me of a comment that Brother Carter made, and I don't think we've come across it yet. I'm not sure. I'm dealing with some chapters ahead and some chapters behind, but somewhere around this area, Brother Carter says that the world judges the truth by the way Christadelphians act. That, of course, is not fair, and it is not right, but there's nothing you can do about it. That's the way people are. And if they see us acting in a way which they don't think is the way that a God-fearing person should act, then they feel quite justified in rejecting God and in rejecting the truth. It's no good listening to what he says because look at what he does. And that's the fact of life. And so here were the Jewish people. They were to be God's ambassadors to the nations. Now as we bear that in mind, we come back to Romans chapter 3 and we come to the apostle's second question, or rather the hypothetical question which he has put into the mouth of a Jewish objector. So the first question is, well, what advantage has the Jew? The answer, much every way, because under him was committed the oracles of God. Well, he says, in the previous chapter you'd said that the Jews had disobeyed. and that by and large they had rejected God's law, and therefore God was going to punish them. So the question is, what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? Take the NIV translation, which tends to make the words believe, unbelief and faith somewhat the same, and gets the flow of the argument. It says, what if some did not have faith? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? So the question is now, if the Jewish people have not manifested faith in God, does that mean that God is going to be unfaithful to his word? Our note says that many who called themselves Jews were not, on the basis of Paul's reasoning. Many rejected Christ, the one promised in the oracles which were placed in their custody. How could God fulfil his word in view of their disbelief? The objective reasons that on Paul's view of the case, the promises could not therefore be fulfilled, and therefore God is not faithful. Surely the divine revelation vouchsafed to him secured his special privilege as the chosen few, for God could not go back on his word. And so you see the reasoning behind that is somewhat complex. But the essence of the question is this. Those people have been unfaithful. Where is God going to stand, therefore, in relation to them? God has said that he is going to make of this race a great nation, a mighty people, and in them all families of the earth are going to be blessed. How is God, therefore, going to remain faithful to his word? Well, actually, it's going to take almost the rest of the book of Romans to totally answer that question. But the one answer which we do get here follows on very beautifully from the previous question. The answer? We have in the King James Version the expression, God forbid. It's not a good expression at all. It doesn't come over that way in the Greek. The word God is not there. It really just means that by no means, or let it not be so. And one would be quite justified, in fact, I believe, in changing that in a reading if they so saw fit, because God forbid, it's very wrong, really, and I don't think it's a good expression to use. So it would be rendered something like, let it not be so, or what was the other one, by no means. So really, it's a very emphatic statement. It's saying, definitely not, by no means. Now, there is no way that God is going to be unfaithful to his word. But you see, the Jew is saying, well, wait a minute, you just told me the Jew is no better than the Gentile, and the Jew that didn't keep the law is going to die just like the Gentiles. Well, how's God going to keep his promises? Well, the answer is, yea, let God be true, but every man a liar. I think we've got Rotherham's translation here, yes. Let God prove to be true, albeit every man be false. Now he says, one thing you can be sure of, if God has made a promise, and we know in the book of Hebrews that he tells us that the promises that he made to Abraham were sworn by an oath. There was no way that that promise could be changed. It was going to be fulfilled. So the Jew, you see, is in a funny position. In his high and mighty way, he says, God needs me. Because he says, in Abraham's seed, these promises are going to be fulfilled. So he can't destroy me. So what are you going to do about that, Paul? Whether I keep the law or whether I don't keep the law? God needs me. It was funny reasoning, but you could see how one could get themselves into a situation where they would think that to be the case. Christadelphians think that, you know, if the Christadelphian community were wiped out, then God would not be able to preach the truth in the earth. Sometimes we think that God is dependent upon us. And that's, of course, not to be meant to be misunderstood. God will use us and God desires to use us. But we must consider it a great privilege that God will channel his word through us and that we can become the medium of it. And the Jew should have seen that. Instead of that, the Jew just sat back in his armchair and boasted in the fact that he was a Jew and looked down upon those who didn't know the truth. All right, let's come back to our question. The question is, what if some were unfaithful? Is God therefore going to be unfaithful? The answer is, in no way. Let it not be so. By no means. God is going to be true, even though every man, may prove to be false. Now here's, of course, the highlight of the answer. Because in order to substantiate his point, he takes an Old Testament quote And looking back here, you may notice that in addition to the yellow colouring in there, I've also got that underlined in red, which is the way that I pick out Old Testament quotes. So there was one over there in chapter 2, verse 19, one down in chapter 2, verse 24, and this one here in the latter part of verse 4. It's a quotation from Psalm 51. Yes, we will go back there in a moment. We're only going to look comparatively briefly at it, and I'll explain the reason at the moment, and we'll go through this all again sometime later on. Psalm 51 was written on the occasion of David, sorry, it was written after the occasion of David's sin in the matter of Bathsheba and in his involvement in... But he went to something greater than the law. He went to the characteristics of God, as have been revealed to the fathers, as have been manifested in the law, and going outside of the law, he prays to God that God might acknowledge his confession. Now, it's this word confession which is the important thing. David in Psalm 51 is not merely asking for forgiveness. That's part of the story. What he is actually doing is confessing his sin. And the very act of confessing his sin is tantamount to declaring that God only is righteous. Now see how we're coming very close now to the theme of the book of Romans. In other words, he is declaring the righteousness of God. Again, it's the theme which we're going to look at in more detail in Romans 4. There are two ways of declaring the righteousness of God. You can do it like Abraham did, by manifesting faith positively, Romans chapter 4 and the first three verses. Or you can do it like David did, when he is arising from a situation of sin, in which he recognises his absolute unworthiness, and in coming to God, he confesses that God only is righteous. And God says, in so doing, you are declaring my righteousness. And so David says, and we've preempted some of his words, verse 4, against thee, thee only have I sinned, and done this evil in thy sight. Now despite the fact that he'd arranged for Uriah to be killed, he committed adultery with Bathsheba, he disgraced the family and the nation, David says, no, it's against Yahweh that I have sinned. And I've done evil in his sight. Because, you see, he recognised the principles of Deuteronomy 4. He had been a recipient of that word. He was a representative of that nation. He had received that word. And therefore, it was a matter of dispensing that word to others. Not just by getting up and speaking about it. Not just by writing psalms, but by acting it out in his life. So he had sinned against Yahweh. But in confessing that sin, what did he do? He declared the righteousness of God. Now, remember the problem we've got in the English language. The problem of this word, righteousness. What's the verb which we use in relation to righteousness? Well, it's not righteousify, is it? Because that word doesn't exist. We have to jump over to another English word and make it justify. I was reading a book recently which used the word enrighteousment, which I thought was quite interesting because it sounded good even though I don't know that the word exists. All right, if we're talking about the righteousness of God, then the verb, of course, means to justify. And so that's why David then says, and here are the words now which are quoted by Paul, that thou, O God, mightest be justified. In other words, that thou, O God, mightest be declared to be right. In other words, that thou, O Yahweh, might be seen to be right. When thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. And so David, in confessing his sin, was declaring the righteousness of God. And what a beautiful thought there, to show to us that we can find ourselves in exactly the same situation. That Yahweh will forgive those who declare his righteousness. It's not so much a matter of coming to God and saying, Lord, forgive me, help me, do this, this and this to me. Those words are quite appropriate in their proper context, but they must find themselves in a context in which God is the dominant thought. I have marred God's glory. Therefore, I want to declare that God alone is right, and I do that in the very act of confessing my sin. We're going to leave Psalm 51 there. I feel loath to do it in many ways, but we will come back to that, as I've said 99 times now, when we get to Romans chapter 4. But going back to Romans 3 now, to pick up the thread of the argument here and not to drag it out to a point where it becomes difficult, we've looked then at the second question. Perhaps by this stage we've almost forgotten what the first question was. Well, the first question was, if the Jews and the Gentiles both stand in a position of condemnation, what advantage is there in being a Jew? Well, because you've been born into the environment of the truth, you've received the oracles of God. That's the first thing. The second question comes, well, what if some did not believe? Does that mean that God will be faithless to his part of the promise? The answer is no, by no means. Let God be true, even though every man may be a liar. As David said in Psalm 51, God has to be declared to be right. And I'm paraphrasing the words there, that thou mightest be justified. Our attitude must be that God must be seen to be right. And if God determines that that person will die, then God is right. If God determines that this person will live, then God is also right. But he will have done it on the basis of an outpouring of mercy which still involves the righteousness of God. And that, of course, is the crux of the issue which we've got to come to grips with later on in chapter 3. How can we, who are sinners, partake of the righteousness of God and receive eternal life? We would think that the only thing that God could rightly do is destroy every one of us. How can he accept the righteousness of another man and impute it unto us? Well, that's the story of Romans 3 and Romans 5. But at the moment, we're still dealing with the problem in the mind of the Jew. And the danger, of course, in a book like this is trying to anticipate too much too fast. But he says, think about that, because the latter part of verse 4 is going to become the crux, really, I think, of our whole life. I really do. Of everything that has to do with our salvation. That thou, O Yahweh, mightest be justified in thy sayings. So you could very rightly condemn me to death, says David. But in the fact of my confessing my sin and imploring you on the basis of your mercy, I believe that you will forgive me. And so I'm confessing my sin, that thou mightest be justified in thy sayings and mightest overcome when thou art judged. Well, that is the way in which the translation has come to us, via the Hebrew, via the Greek, via whatever other languages it went through before it got to the English, which makes it sound a little bit different from what we have in the Old Testament rendering of Psalm 51. But the Old Testament rendering is a little easier to understand than what we have there in Psalm 51 and verse 4. And so, as we said, the law provided no sacrifice to cover David's sin. But because David sought to honour God by declaring his righteousness in the confession of his sin, God demonstrated his ability to deal with human sin without impairing his own plan of salvation. This thought becomes the basis of all of Paul's reasoning in the following chapters and is vital to a proper understanding of the doctrine of the atonement. So we come then to question number 3, found in verse 5. But, says verse 5, if our unrighteousness commend the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unrighteous who taketh vengeance? And Paul feels that he, you know, although they are the words of a hypothetical objector, he finds the idea is so repulsive that he puts in brackets, I speak as a man. I want you to understand it's not my ideas. This is what a Jewish man would say. Look how this Jewish man is now straining it. He's saying, oh, I see what happens. David committed a sin. He came along and confessed that sin. And in confessing that sin, he actually elevated God. He declared God to be righteous. Well, that means then that the worse sin we commit, the more we can elevate God. Now, if you haven't come across that thought before in this part of Romans, you've certainly read it in Romans chapter 6 and verse 1, haven't you? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? You see, if God's grace can be extended to someone who comes along and in the act of confessing his sin declares God to be righteous, and God therefore extends grace, the Jewish mind could say, well, the more I sin, the more grace I can get. And people actually did think that way. They did actually think that way. And here we're seeing the seeds of it already here in this question. If our unrighteousness commend or elevate or exalts the righteousness of God, well then, how is it that God is going to take vengeance on people who've disobeyed him? That's not right. Let's read our note at the top of page 21. The protesting Jew could argue that his wickedness actually serves to emphasise God's holiness. You see how he's picking up the thought of that second question. In which event, since God's holiness is upheld by being contrasted with the Jewish man's unholiness, it would be unjust of God to bring his wrath on such a person. Is not this the basis on which God forgave David, as quoted in Psalm 51, verse 4? And that question you might put afterward, I speak as a man. This proposition is so abhorrent to the Apostle Paul that he hastens to add, I speak according to man, as the Diaglot has it. And so the answer which comes to us in verse 6 is simply this, and again that expression, God forbid, means let it not be so, for then how shall God judge the world? And so, as we suggest, that in answering the Jew, he would say to the Jew that you are really suggesting that man can therefore sin with impunity. That's what you're really saying. Taking your argument to a logical extreme, he's saying you are really saying that man can sin with impunity. If this were the case, then the doctrine of a coming world judgment would be absurd. And our quote from Genesis 18, verse 25, I think is very appropriate. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And in its context in Genesis chapter 18, that's a very beautiful quotation. You know, to keep the balance in this thing, certainly, as the Lord said, to whom much has been forgiven, I don't forget how this quote goes now, it was in regard to Mary Magdalene, wasn't it, about how she loved much? And he was, if someone gets the quote quite right, you just tell me. But it says that those who have been forgiven much love much. You know, that's the general idea, isn't it? So that a man like David, who committed a dreadful sin, he really feels that he has received a lot more grace. And that's right, and we mustn't dispute that, and we should feel that way. And we should never try to play down the enormity of our sin. We've got to realise that anything that falls short of the manifesting of the glory of God is sin. We don't play it down. We recognise it for what it is, and we realise just how much grace God has given unto us. But you don't therefore turn around and say, well, now, if I do a much bigger sin tomorrow, I can get a lot more grace the next day. And that's what this Jewish questioner was actually saying. Luke 7, verse 47. Could you just read that out for us? Thanks, Ben.
Yeah, wherefore I say unto thee, her sins which are many are forgiven, for she loved much, but to whom little is forgiven, the same love.
Yes, it's very appropriate, and I think that all of us, when we come to a situation in life where something really bad happens, we appreciate God's grace much more than when we appear to be going along on an apparently even keel. You notice I use the word appear and apparently, because it's usually when things appear to be going well that they're not, and we mustn't be lulled into a false sense of security. All right, our third question then has simply stated, well, look, if you follow that through to its logical conclusion, then you are saying that there is no way in which there's going to be a judgment of the world, and that would be untrue. You can see now how the questions are getting quite extreme, until we finally come to the fourth question. And the fourth question, which is found in verse 7, is this. God hath more abounded through for if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I also judged as a sinner? In other words, he says that if I tell a bigger lie, then God's truth becomes more obvious. And not rather as we be slanderously reported, and so, as some affirm that we say, let us do evil that good may come. And apparently the Apostle Paul was being quoted as saying that. Can you see how to the Jew that doctrine of grace might have been interpreted that way? And that's where we get it again in chapter 6. That they were saying, well, okay, you're telling us then that if you do something wrong, you don't come along and offer a sacrifice. What you are saying is you come to God, you confess your sin, you acknowledge the righteousness of God, and God will extend grace unto you. What you're saying then is that let us do evil that good may come of it. Let us sin that we may receive grace. Well, whilst it is true that those who have sinned can receive God's grace, we don't deliberately sin so that we may therefore force God to offer us his grace. That's how that reasoning comes through. Just read that question again. For if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I also judged as a sinner? And not rather, as we be slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, let us do evil, that good may come. So the questioner is saying, surely then my sin gives God scope to display his kindness. Therefore let us do evil, that good may come. In fact, is not that what you, Paul, actually teach? And his answer? The Authorised Version translation is very poor there because it appears to make it the continuation of a sentence. You notice the question mark at the end of the second to last line there, do evil that good may come. Well, that's the end of a sentence. The answer simply is, their condemnation is deserved. So he's not even going to bother to answer the question. He says, people who think like that, their condemnation is deserved. Well, you can see now what Brother Carter said, meant when he said that some would say that the Epistle to the Romans is the most profound book in the world. There are parts where you do get this reasoning. And I think this is the part of the book which makes it sound quite profound. We don't get any more questions and answers for a little while yet. So, you know, not every study is going to be like that. But it's good if we can sort of follow this through. And then next time we read it, see if we can pick out the questions and the answers. What he has done then is he has answered these objections to show really that that no man stands justified in the sight of God on the basis of his own works, the works of the law, or the works of any law. The next section, which starts in verse 9 and goes through to verse 20, says, what then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise, for we have before proved, both Jews and Gentiles, that they are all under sin. And so that's been very clearly established. Doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or a Gentile, you are all under sin. Now in verses 10 through to 18, we've got a series of Old Testament quotations, and believe it or not, we're not going to look up any of those. We're just going to leave them as they stand. You may like to follow them through. There's certainly some very beautiful quotations there, but I don't intend to actually pick those up, except perhaps as we see them here in the notes, to notice which particular verses are quoting which particular Old Testament passages. And they all come either from the Psalms or Isaiah. And we notice there that verses 10, 11 and 12 are from Psalm 14, verses 1 to 3. The first part of verse 13 is Psalm 5 verse 9, and the second part of verse 13 is Psalm 140 verse 3. Verse 14 is a quote from Psalm 10 verse 7. And verses 15, 16 and 17 are Isaiah 59 verses 7 and 8. And verse 18 is Psalm 36 verse 1. So these passages are all put together in order to substantiate the fact that there are none righteous, none are righteous, all are gone out of the way, as verse 9 has said. And so reading those verses through, we read that. There is none righteous, says verse 10, not one. There is none that understandeth, there is none that seeketh after God. They're all gone out of the way, they are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Their throat is an open sepulchre, With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace have they not known. And there is no fear of God before their eyes. All linking those Psalms and Isaiah together. Well, that brings us down then to verses 19 and 20, which really conclude this section and lay the basis for the next section, which will be the righteousness of God revealed and how it has come to us. So, verse 19 says, "Now we know that what things soever the law said, it saith for them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Therefore, by works of law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by law is the knowledge of sin." And that brings to a conclusion that particular section. He's really summarised all of the features there. Our notes pick up, I think, the main feature here, and to save time, I think we might just see what that note says directly. We say, hence then, in verses 19 and 20, and the NIV translates it this way, "Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God," which is a better translation really than what we have there where it says that all the world may become guilty before God. "Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin." And so whilst it concludes that section then, that in chapter 1, the Gentile world was shown to be deserving of God's wrath, chapter 2 shows to us that the Jewish world, if it did not live up to the things which had been given to it, also deserved God's wrath. It showed in the opening verses of chapter 3 the reasoning of the Jew who was trying to justify himself rather than seek the mercy in the way in which God had provided. It showed that there was no hope either outside of the law or even inside the law, because he's going to show to us now in the succeeding verses that the law of Moses was holy, it was just and it was good, but it was never intended to give a man eternal life. What it did was it magnified sin. As we saw in our study of the offerings, there were no sin offerings before the law of Moses. It introduced a new offering to concentrate on the subject of sin. And so as he's going to tell us, it's going to condemn the world, if you like. It's going to convince them that they are sinners. And so it was thus given to prevent boasting and to establish a need for a redeemer. And as we consider Paul's reasonings on the law, we're going to have to keep that very delicate balance. At times we find ourselves getting to the point where we almost think that the law was something bad. But it wasn't. It was extremely good for what it was intended to do. What it was intended to do was to prevent boasting, to bring the Jew back to his proper level. It was to establish in him the sense of a need of a redeemer, for the blood of bulls and goats could never take away sin. He must have a redeemer. It therefore follows that deeds of law could not bring justification, but only the knowledge, epignosis, the experiential knowledge, if you like, of what sin was all about. And it's going to be on that point that he's going to take up his reasonings as he now, in the following verses, looks at the way in which God has provided the Lord Jesus Christ as the better way. And so we've considered then in these opening three chapters the way in which, as we saw in our subdivisions there, that the doctrine of the righteousness of God is being demonstrated, that man, by and large, has totally failed to attain to God's righteousness. Therefore, we're going to appreciate more than ever, as we study this section of the Epistle to the Romans, of what God has done for us in providing his Son as the way by which we might be partakers of the righteousness of God.